Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. Back in September 2021, we wanted to discuss blockchain and cryptocurrencies. Will Campion, my co-founder, was more enthusiastic than me, but we arranged to meet with Nick Carey, one of the founders and vice chair at blockchain.com, through a friend of the show, James Peterson at Rothschild. Blockchain was then becoming the world's leading digital assets platform. Nick arrived for the preparatory meeting at my home with his Vizsla, a beautiful, if scatty, tobacco-brown Hungarian dog whose exuberance persuaded my chocolate-brown Labrador to retreat under the table. Nick then proceeded to speak with great eloquence and fluidity about the blockchain technology, the world of crypto, currency debasement, government failures, and the death of cash. Despite my reservations, when we recorded, the conversation was rich and wide-ranging, and we spilled over into two episodes. Nevertheless, I was, and have remained, a skeptic about the investment merits of cryptocurrencies. Since then, Bitcoin's price more than doubled, then more than halved, and more than doubled again. Its price when we did the interview was $45,000. When I started doing my research notes only 3 weeks ago, it was $50,000. Today, I think it closed around $67,000. And during the same time frame, FTX under Sam Bankman-Fried rose, collapsed, and he's now incarcerated. Binance and Coinbase were sued by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. And on 11th of January this year, Bitcoin ETFs were approved by the SEC. Never a dull moment in crypto land. Nick Carey, welcome back to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back. We do have quite a bit to cover in just a few short years. This feels like a decade of traditional finance.
And gracing us today is my co-founder and business partner, Will Campion, who for the first time is here on the Maze stage. Will, welcome.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to see you again, Nick. I would say one of the treats we've had of this four-year journey is, like you, Nick, many people who've been on the show have become friends, and that's super special to interview you with Simon today.
Well, I'm really glad to have both of you today, so we can address some skepticism and we can
just
look
for
at
the record. I'm a firm believer, so we'll see if we can persuade Simon to slightly change his view as we sail on through this conversation.
Thank you, Will. Let's start with blockchain.com. Remind us what you do.
So thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about blockchain.com. We actually founded blockchain.com in 2011 in a little town in northern England called York, which I always like because New York is always well known as being the sort of home of modern traditional finance. And I think there's some kind of historical beauty to sort of the story we have, which is founding the largest digital asset platform in the world in Old York. And I also think it sort of speaks to the special relationship between the United States and the UK, too. This has been my home now for over a decade, and the UK is really our sort of home turf. So blockchain.com, established in 2011, is the digital assets platform that serves both institutions and retail customers. We've had over 90 million wallet holders in almost every country around the world. We started off as a data platform. We built the wallet, we built an exchange, and we've been serving institutions now for about 5 years, which has become a major part of our business. And so we have a lot of different product offerings. We serve a lot of different customer segments, and we have a very serious business. It's a global company. I serve on the board of directors along with people that include the former officer of the control of the currency of the U.S. government, Joseph Otting. We have Jim Messina, who was the deputy White House chief of staff and some of the most impressive businesses in the world. Tom Horton serves on the board of directors alongside myself and my business partner. He was a former chairman and CEO of American Airlines and serves as the lead independent director of Walmart.
So you have on your website a very interesting thing called the heat map, which anybody who wants to know about this space, whatever their persuasions, will find very informative. And I think on there it said, because I'm fast out of date, the cryptocurrency market, as of 2 weeks ago, was valued at over $2 trillion. Just give us a recap of the market today.
The very first cryptocurrency that some of the listeners may be familiar with is a cryptocurrency called Bitcoin. And it was introduced basically as originally a concept or a white paper in 2008, 2009. It envisioned the development of a transactional network that had a currency, a ledger, or a way to keep track of who owned what, and then it had a capability to perform settlement with finality. And so this network was launched and started to gain some early traction, basically between 2009 and 2011. And then some of the first companies in the cryptocurrency industry started to form, ourselves included. It would take a few years for marketplaces to develop and exchanges to be created. And once that happened, you started to see pretty significant retail adoption. But the retail adoption, which has really driven crypto up until, frankly, this year, has created essentially almost $3 trillion alternative asset class. And this is why this moment is so special, because in the past 8 weeks, we've seen the crystallization in a lot of ways and legitimacy of this whole asset class being crystallized by the launch of the ETFs from the traditional financial houses on Wall Street. So besides Bitcoin, though, there are now thousands and thousands of digital currencies and digital assets. They range in very sophisticated platforms to even more silly things. And famously, Elon Musk, who you were referencing earlier today, is a big proponent of a digital currency called Dogecoin, which, of course, is a competitor to some of the more established, and I would say, crypto and digital asset ecosystems that have very strong, robust communities. And foundationally, they all sort of rely on similar principles, which is having a digital asset of some kind of record-keeping system, and then some kind of settlement to ensure that people can transact with each other with certainty.
To quote William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, what's in a name? A belief in blockchain technology doesn't equal a belief in crypto. Isn't your company's name a bit of a misnomer?
So we named the company probably before there was any sort of what I would describe as positive brand confusion about any of this. So all these underlying cryptocurrencies and protocols rely on some type of a blockchain. So what is a blockchain? A blockchain is basically a decentralized record-keeping system that stays in a constant state of agreement. It's a database, but it has some novel features, including being decentralized. So this is a really big breakthrough in computer science. It means that basically you can have a large worldwide network that is constantly staying in a state of synchronicity, meaning it's always being updated and always in a state of agreement. And when you have a system that can do something like that, you can pioneer all kinds of different features and all kinds of different concepts on it. One of those concepts would be peer-to-peer electronic cash. Others would be decentralized applications, meaning software systems that can basically run on a decentralized network. And now we're seeing even more novel use cases, everything from digital art to intelligent assets. And there's all kinds of work being done right now at the intersection between decentralization and artificial intelligence, which is a very important and topical concept to dig into a little bit later in the podcast. It has profound implications for how we understand what is truthful, how these models are being developed, and who has access to the underlying data itself, and how we compensate the people that collect that data, create the content in the world, and essentially distribute it.
Can I just press you a little bit on, I'd love to understand more about the journey and where we're at with being able to fractionalize and trade different asset classes through the blockchain technology. Could you just give us a bit more color on what potentially might happen in the next 2 or 3 years, whether we'll be all owning a fraction of a building? You mentioned some art. Is it going to be commodities? Could it be platinum? What could we all end up being able to have in our portfolios in the future?
There's a lot of people concentrated on building the future of finance and changing the relationship people have with their money. And it sits on a few different rails. One of them is basically increasing transactional capacity for the internet. So if we're going to have basically a lot more transactions happening over the internet, we have to increase the capacity of these transactional networks. So it's sort of obvious, but for example, in London, we have a lot of small streets. It's very difficult to move and drive through these streets quickly. You need to have highways or you need to have a tube system to do that. Technical networks are not dissimilar. They have to have capacity in order to deal with demand. We've seen significant demand in digital currency networks over the previous decade. the anticipated throughput that will be needed is relatively extraordinary. Everything from supporting worldwide digital payments on the internet to micropayments to fractional ownership of all assets, all these things will require a significant amount of transactional capacity. So one of the main things that's being developed in our industry are what are called layer two protocols. These basically sit above the foundational protocols and are specifically focused on increasing transactional capability.
So let's just stay with blockchain for a minute, because I think most of us incredulously would say that the old certainties are being lost and AI is accelerating to the point where, you know, within a short space of time, we won't actually know for sure if the news article is based on truth or if the video is completely fake. And blockchain, there is a suggestion, offers this verification. Just explain a little bit about how blockchain can be a force for validation.
I would say the work to be done in order to validate data on a worldwide level is basically one of the most pressing issues we have today. And the reason is pretty obvious. The way these large language models work is they collect large amounts of data, and then that data is basically weighted, and then models are run against it, against those weights. And then what we've seen over the last few months is that there have been essentially filters applied to those large language models, sometimes by compliance departments, sometimes by legal teams, or by the commercial interests of the large platforms that are collecting that information. And when you run an inquiry against that, an inference against that data set, you can get hallucinations. So if you ask it to basically make you a photograph or design an image of four medieval knights, it might put, you know, characters on those medieval knights that are completely historically inaccurate. And so we're developing a hyper-intelligent system that is hyper-censored and hyper-condescending to us. And this is absolutely problematic. And even more concerning is that there's almost no way to check whether the veracity of the underlying models is accurate. When Larry Fink talks about cryptocurrencies and the use of blockchain technology to create an entire informatics asset class, he's starting to see the vision for all of this, which is if you can give data essentially a property right, individual DNA to every single piece of information, you can then reward that information for being accurate. And so what blockchain technology basically makes it possible to do is give everything in the world a digital property right, essentially a counterfeit resistant, a string of letters and numbers that is prescribed to a specific asset, a specific piece of information, a real world asset, or a digital piece of art. And so if you start to think about it, it's like a property rights system for the internet, using this immutable record-keeping technology that also has native settlement built into it. So in the next few years, I expect to see far more tokenization of real-world assets, whether that's things like gold, whether that's things like property, whether that's things like music catalogs or alternative assets, and enabling a much wider market structure and a retail offering that makes it possible for regular people to have access to these things.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsors. Earlier this year, I spoke to David Neal, CEO of IFM Investors, who shared the firm's strategy and mission to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of 120 million working people. We're pleased to now be sponsored by IFM Investors, who are owned by pension funds and inspired by their members. They were set up in Australia 30 years ago, and today have a truly global footprint, operating across 11 cities and employing over 600 people. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. They're a responsible and long-term investor too, actively engaging with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, helping to improve performance whilst minimizing risk. Please tap the link in the episode description to learn more.
So, Nick, you've mentioned Simon's favourite four-letter word in the world.
It's G-O-L-D.
G-O-L-D. Can we just get your thoughts on digital gold? Just use that as an example. I think it's a great competitor to Bitcoin. Where are they at with that process? What might we be seeing in there?
So I also share a mutual love of gold. And I think a lot of people that originally started out in digital currency, and specifically with Bitcoin, came to it via an appreciation for hard assets and sound money. And so gold holds a special place in my heart due to its physical properties, its use as a form of money and a store of value. And so gold has specific properties that give it social utility and economic utility and utility in industrial processes. So there's a reason why gold has been valued by civilizations for thousands of years. You know, I think if we just go back a little bit in the money maze through the lens of history and think about what money really is, you know, money is a prehistoric concept. It predates man's written word. It's why we find in burial tombs in northern Scotland, beads from the Middle East, people have been trading and exchanging goods and services for other things using different technologies. So whether it was bartering or the use of beads or the use of exotic feathers or cigarettes in World War II to break in and out of prisons and settle debts between soldiers, to cash instruments, to gold, we've always sort of applied an appropriate technology for the existing market structure and the economy of the time. So to me, it's not a big surprise that we are now as entering basically what is broadly described as the fourth industrial revolution, needing to reinvent and reevaluate our relationship with the technology that underpins how we transact wealth between each other. So what is money? I would say money is just a social construct that we all consent to that enables us to exchange wealth over time. And we've used a lot of different technologies to do that. I still think gold has a very valuable role in a portfolio for an investor. But I also think so does real estate. I think so do certain commodities. I think bonds do. I think a position in potentially some stable cash would always be responsible. But I also think if you're looking into the future, you know, the use of digital currencies that are far more liquid, that have the ability to transact more readily and can basically travel across borders instantly and settle for very low cost, there's a role for those too. And we're already seeing the adoption of these types of assets, both as a form of money and a store of value. And so Bitcoin specifically took a lot of lessons from gold and tried to basically engineer them into software. So you've got scarcity designed into the total currency supply. It becomes more difficult to acquire over time. And there's less and less of it as it basically comes into circulation over the next 140 years. And that drives certain dynamics in the price structure of Bitcoin, where there's less and less of it, and it's still more and more popular. And so when you've got something that's scarce and useful, and you've got a market of people that want to buy it, then you have a price, and the price fluctuates with that supply and demand. And that's why this four-year cycle is so critical, because every 4 years, the total number of circulating Bitcoin will decrease by 50%.
So we had Scott Besson on the show, who is was George Soros' CIO. I think he just nicely encapsulates it, is that, you know, Bitcoin is a risk-on asset. As I look through your website, your health warning is do not invest unless you are prepared to lose all the money you invest. This is a high-risk investment. Now, when Bitcoin started, there was a nice little explanation that this was going to be a medium of exchange, and that hasn't transpired. I mean, aren't we simply dealing with a means of speculation?
So I want to address a couple things that you just brought up. So cryptocurrencies have had a lot of volatility in finding product market fit, as I would describe it, over the last decade. The risk warnings you see on the blockchain.com website are part of our requirements here in the UK for financial promotions. Those were implemented in October. Quite interesting, because since October, the value of digital assets has more than doubled. And these types of warnings are not applied to other financial services firms, interestingly. And so the type of sort of warnings that are imposed here were designed intentionally to basically help provide some consumer protections. But what they've also done is slow down the rate of adoption of digital currencies here in the UK, which is sort of, I would say, counterintuitive to the intention behind the financial promotions regulations. We're obviously all in favor of consumer protections, but if you don't make it accessible for people here in the UK to acquire these things on regulated venues, you one, lose the wealth creation for those potential investors, the tax benefits from those, and then the companies that work in this space lose revenue as well because of the frictions in the onboarding. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about that, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to. As far as it being a risk on asset, I sent Campo this amazing chart. So hopefully the editors can maybe put it in this part of the podcast, but it shows the federal funds rate, and then it shows the market capitalization of Bitcoin. And if you look at it in 2019, 2020, when the Fed rate is at like 2%, crypto markets are relatively subdued. Then you have COVID, federal fund rate drops completely. We're flushing money into the economy to help stimulate, you know, the businesses and investment, and everything gets hot. You know, the stock market reaches all-time highs. Every asset class in the world starts to see significant increases in value. Crypto as well rages. And then there's a correction in 2022. Tech equities collapse. Crypto experiences a significant number of self-inflicted issues, including famously the FTX collapse. And then the federal rate starts to increase dramatically. And right now you're in a very wild situation, which is very high federal funds rate, and the crypto market has responded extremely positively. And so looking into the future, you've got supply dynamics that are going to cause arguably the price of at least Bitcoin and its tangential assets to be affected, arguably positively. You have, you know, the Fed indicating it may reduce its federal funds rate over the next 6 to 12 months. You have a U.S. election that's happening. So there's a lot of things that are sort of conspiring to potentially make this asset class even more, I would say, favorable to investor conditions. And so, yeah, on the risk on asset side of it, I do think that crypto is risky. People need to do their research. And there's a huge difference between, I would say, some of the emergent projects that have not been tested in the market and ones that have been around for a while. This is why working with firms that have an established record, that have been there for their customers and have navigated the volatility of these cycles over the previous decade is so critical for consumers and investors to understand.
In studying these things, and we might put your chart on and we'll put another chart on where we show the high correlation in Bitcoin and risk and positive risk assets. We've had a cheap money fueled rally replaced by a everything will work out fine rally, even in a narrowing market. And Bitcoin has been a beneficiary, I would argue, of that higher risk appetite. We'll see how it fares when a downturn, which is inevitable, comes. One of the arguments, and you've hinted at it, but you're not alone, is scarcity. And the case for having Bitcoin is the supply side. But I've struggled with that because scarcity on its own doesn't confer value and mean that in the long term, something will increase in its worth.
Can I just interject here as well? Because I know we've been talking about Bitcoin a lot, but Nick, can you bring in the other players in the market? Ethereum, you know, you talked about that on the last podcast. There's many other digital coins and currencies. Can you explain a bit how they're reacting in the system as well?
Yeah, I'm not going to let Simon not be completely off the hook here, because I hope desperately that I can not necessarily persuade him to completely come over to the other side here, but just to understand that I agree. Scarcity is a necessity for things to have a certain level of potential value, but the other is utility. And so those two features in combination are critical to Bitcoin's success and have also been critical to the success of other historical financial systems like a gold-backed economy. And so if you have something that's useful and scarce, it commands a market price. And that is really what the feature set that Bitcoin has attempted to implement over the previous decade has done. In a lot of ways, Bitcoin fell into an interesting product market fit, which has been described as digital gold, and it has served as that function and not as much of a function as a peer-to-peer cash system for the internet, which is what it was originally envisioned to do. That has now been taken over by other crypto protocol projects and other digital assets. So there are some important ones for listeners to learn a little bit more about. Probably the most relevant is a digital currency called Ethereum. It's been now in the market for almost a decade. It is the second largest digital currency by market cap and has gone through significant improvements and upgrades. And so while Bitcoin has arguably been slower to actually improve and update itself, other protocols are now moving very quickly. And this thing is basically more like a worldwide computer. It is designed to support the essentially launch of completely autonomous digital agreements, software programs that run in a decentralized way on the internet. And it's a far more complex system. So if you've got a use case for basically just digital gold, now you've got a use case for far more sophisticated agreements that can self-execute on the internet. So an example of one of those agreements would be, well, let's all make a bet. You think Bitcoin's going to zero.
Yeah.
I think Bitcoin's going to 100,000. We could all put 50 pounds into a digital agreement. And when one of those conditions happened, the digital agreement would execute and it would pay out its reward to the participants of that agreement. And that is interesting, it's useful, and that's a novel use case of what's called a smart contract, which would probably execute on something like the Ethereum network. These networks are also now being used to issue something called stable coins, which are just digital dollars, digital pounds, or digital euros. And there's been this conversation about, well, should central banks potentially explore the use of blockchain technology to create central bank digital currencies, having a direct relationship between consumers and the central bank. I think when all the research is complete and all the working parties finish spending their time on this, they'll come to the conclusion that they don't need to do anything. Central banks already have the tools they need to basically affect monetary policy. And now they have these digital utility networks that can basically mint dollar tokens that allow anyone in the world to have essentially a dollar-denominated bank account on their phone, or a pound-denominated bank account on their phone, or a euro-denominated bank account.
Or
anything. And so these are particularly useful, though, because now you can basically beam dollars over the internet without having to wait for a settlement window, without having to go through a Forex market. And anybody on Earth that has a smartphone can download a digital wallet and use these digital dollars, digital pounds, or digital euros. So even if you don't like Bitcoin or Ethereum or some of these other protocols, you can start to think of them as a utility layer for settlement on the internet. And they are used by financial services firms to create digital dollars, digital pounds, and more, just to do basic things like send money over the internet.
But Nick, I understand your conviction. But if I want to go afterwards to Pret and buy a sandwich, or I want to go to an electronic shop and buy a computer, I can't use any cryptocurrencies to do it.
You can. Online shops, there's plenty that allow you to buy things with digital currency. So Microsoft accepts cryptocurrency for payments for Xbox. You could buy computers on the internet. You can buy compute for AI and much more. But I agree. On the high street, if you were across into Oxford Circus today and try and shop with digital currency, I think most of the retail point of sale people would look at you a bit odd. But they would also not accept cash anymore. And it's likely you would have to use a credit card. And, you know, if you were to look just 5-10 years ago, the adoption of different mediums for exchange has already permeated the way we transact on a day-to-day basis. You know, we don't even use instruments look anything like our parents did. So I think if you just sort of put the lens of technological adoption on, you can see where within 5-10 years, you know, you may have a wallet on your phone. It is going to use whatever asset, you know, as a collection of assets that you have on your wallet or your brokerage account or whatever, and it'll immediately convert what is most valuable and transact on it instantly. And all those types of swaps, all those things require digitally native tooling to achieve. And so, you know, longer term, these things will get adopted at a brick and mortar level for a variety of reasons, but most likely just because of the transactional efficiency. But I agree, we have a lot of work to do here, and there's still a huge amount of opportunity really at the last mile where you're making payments for regular things.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. And it was actually Will, your colleague Ed Bradley Norman, who said to me, if you were trying to escape a country, as people had done from Germany in the 1930s, being able to, you know, secrete diamonds or gold is a lot easier than trying to get something that requires electricity and verification. And so there is something that is inherently more difficult than back to the gold or other more easily transactable items. I'd like to talk about the institutional universe. And let's maybe just start with you, because you were a new business financed by venture capitalists. I think if I'm right, you had Sequoia, Google Ventures, Richard Branson, Bailey Gifford as your backers. VC had a repricing, as we know, after an extraordinary explosion in those rates rose. How are your investors feeling about their investment in your company?
So in 2022, Blockchain.com raised a significant amount of funds at a $14 billion valuation. We then saw the tech equities market dramatically drop, everything from PayPal to our rivals, you know, to Amazon, saw huge corrections. And then things have started to turn around. We raised more money for our business. So we put about $1 billion into the company over the previous decade. Our investors see a long-term play with our company. And that's something we've been very careful to curate with our investor group. We see this world that I'm describing to you, where there's frictionless payments over the internet, and having a foundational company that is right in the center of supporting the adoption of these technologies and tools is critical for people that see that future. And so our business is doing very well. We've had the best quarter of our company's history in the past basically 4 months since 2022. And we see things turning around very, very nicely this year. And on the institutional side, you know, of adoption, I would not discount just how significant the ETFs are. And so you had basically a $3 trillion asset class that was created by retail adoption and retail investors. And now, after a decade of every argument being thrown at this thing, I would say it's been through a very hostile discovery process for product market fit. You know, the SEC tried for a long time to slow down any type of ETF. And famously, there were applications made in 2014, almost every year from the previous decade.
Yeah.
So finally, after these things were challenged in the courts, the SEC has changed its perspective and has approved ETFs. BlackRock's ETF launch of their Bitcoin product is the most successful ETF launch in BlackRock's history. It took 37 days for them to get over $10 billion in AUM, and they're not alone. WisdomTree, Fidelity, and the other 10 ETFs that were all approved simultaneously are all performing very well. I think everyone's actually quite surprised by the level of interest from these retail products. And to me, I think if I look back on it, I don't know if I even appreciated just how much wealth and capital is sort of stored in the investor class in their 401ks in the United States that now has access to a secured, highly regulated investment product through their trusted financial services firms. And so this has opened up a huge new market. And there's going to be more of these ETFs approved for alternative digital assets over the next few years. So I'm quite bullish on these changes in the market structure.
And Nick, can I just come back? I think you said you had 90 million wallets.
Yes.
Could you just give us a little bit of background on the growth of that? And what your company and platform will be able to provide listeners to this podcast in how and what they can invest in?
So when I described earlier the sort of phases of bull and bear markets over the previous decade, one of the challenging things to navigate as a business in this industry is that when there is a bull cycle, you see a huge surge in activity. And so you see between 2 and 10 times the number of users signing up, transacting, and this type of growth puts extraordinary stress on technological systems, on people systems, on your risk systems across the entire business. And so there are these short periods of time where you have to be accommodating to a large number of new economic participants. And we're just starting to see that new wave of economic participants over the past 3 months across our platform and across other industry players. And so we've had 90 million people sign up for a blockchain.com wallet. The reason it's been popular is because it's free. You can find it in the App Store and you can sign up today. And after you input your personal information, a passport or a driver's license, and go through a KYC and PEPs and sanctions check, you can acquire and buy £5 or €5 of a variety of different digital assets. Most people pick something they're familiar with, something like Bitcoin or Ethereum. We have over 350 digital assets that people can explore within the blockchain.com platform.
Well, Nothing, as a friend of the show, had this question, which was, with exploring blockchain data being in the corporate DNA, can you talk about interesting projects to seed before others because you have this competitive advantage?
One of the things that we are privileged to have insights into are just emerging trends. And so in 2022, 23, a lot of people were just rotating into risk-off assets. They just wanted to hold digital versions of gold. So it was a digital gold token. They wanted to hold more dollars. They wanted to hold, you know, basically fiat. And so we support digital versions of those things as people rotate out of risk and hold them in their wallets. Alternatively, though, into the future, you can see now these type of gaming tokens are actually particularly interesting. A lot of young adults spend a huge amount of time on online entertainment. And there's a lot of interesting use cases for everything from fan tokens for large sports games like the Premier League to video game economies. So that's an emerging trend we're seeing. Digital art was a big one. And fractional ownership, I think, is going to be a particularly interesting new opportunity for people over the next few years.
So I watched the brilliant, brutal, and tragic Navalny on Prime last night, and if people haven't watched it, it's quite breathtaking and quite awful. And at one point, they're trying to access data that is illegal, and so they go onto the dark web and they pay for it with crypto. So tell me why this isn't a great place for bad actors to operate.
Okay, let's talk about that. And I think we should address it head on. So maybe we go through sort of the environmental, social, and governance, you know, framework for digital currencies and Bitcoin. So in the Ukrainian example, right after Russia invaded the Ukraine, the Ukrainian government put out an all-points bulletin saying, hey, guys, we need help. They asked Western governments for support, for munitions, for security agreements. And one of the things they also did was ask for economic donations. And over the course of just a few days, they put up a cryptocurrency wallet, and over $100 million worth of donations by people all over the world were instantly beamed to the support of Ukraine. And I think this speaks to an incredible ability for digital currencies to reach across borders to instantly support humanitarian and crisis situations. It's been regularly commented on and argued that these things are highly energy intensive and that causes environmental damage, and that's problematic. And so let's break that one down a little bit. So if we look at the underlying data, and one of the benefits of cryptocurrencies is that because they are transparent, because the networks are running on these blockchains, we can actually compute the energy consumption of that network. So we can understand what the externalities are, which is completely different than we could do, for example, say, what is the economic or the environmental damage of, say, building Canary Wharf or, you know, getting gold out of the Earth's crust, highly environmentally damaging. So we know what the energy consumption is of Bitcoin, for example. It takes roughly 0.55% of worldwide energy. So that's a decent amount. Bitcoin does not cause scope one emissions. So a scope one emission is basically a machine that spits out, you know, basically combustion into the atmosphere. So it's more focused in what's called scope two emissions, just like electric cars. And what's interesting is that the network that supports Bitcoin basically uses all of these computers all over the world to maintain the integrity of the network. That network now holds over $1 trillion of value. So you want to have a lot of energy and a lot of security protecting all of that value locked up into it. So there's social utility in the use of this energy. And so if we're going to have an honest conversation, yes, cryptocurrencies use a lot of energy, but they're also trying to find the most renewable, most affordable energy sources in the world. And you know, if we wanted to compare the total energy consumption of Bitcoin to, say, something a lot of people find useful, but I would argue is not necessarily has a ton of social utility, you would compare it to the total use of, say, tumble dryers in the world. So tumble dryers help make sure we don't have soggy clothes to go to work, but at the end of the day, they use an extraordinary amount of energy. And you don't see anyone calling for the banning of those things. And I think we should just be honest about exploring whether or not we find social utility in the use of those energies. So on the energy piece, I think that's sort of an interesting perspective to look at. There are also examples of pretty interesting initiatives. There's one in Canada where they're actually using crypto mining machines to help warm social housing and help heat large communities of apartment buildings. So I think there's kind of interesting little use cases like that. On the social piece, one of the criticisms of crypto is that it's been used for illicit activity. And so in the case you just described, interestingly persecuted political rival to, you know, Putin has to resort to using alternative forms of transacting in order to acquire information, to send messages, to get data that is relevant and needed to them. So I don't think maybe anyone would argue that that person shouldn't have access to being able to try and do those things in an oppressed, you know, political environment. But then again, we also don't want bad actors to use these things to do more controversial things or undermine our democracies. And so an interesting report came out last year run by Chainalysis. Again, because the transactional networks are fully transparent, we can actually run analysis on how many of these payments are going through things like the dark web or illicit marketplaces. And fewer than 0.24% of worldwide Bitcoin transactions are involved in illicit activity. The United Nations issued a report last year that said somewhere between 2 and 5% of worldwide GDP is used in money laundering and illicit activity. And so, again, if you're going to have an honest conversation about it, while these things are not perfect, they are much less used by bad actors, partially because of this transparency capability. Every major bad actor that has done something very bad with crypto has left a digital trail that lets the intelligence agencies, that lets the police and investigative agencies essentially a fingerprint of what they've done. And so the bad actors would be very, very foolish to use digital currencies and crypto networks to conduct illicit activity in the long run. I think they believe they can maybe get away with it in the short run, but that is a misplaced concept.
But Nick, can I just come in on this? You say you leave a fingerprint. That's what I thought years ago. But is that fingerprint not allowing them to be brought to justice? What's a fingerprint?
So what I'm saying is that every time you perform a transaction on a digital crypto protocol, that transaction gets loaded into the Bitcoin or crypto blockchain. So it's forever essentially financial archaeology. But every subsequent transaction is also tied partially to that fingerprint. So if your personal identity is actually ever leaked from one of these crypto exchanges that you use, it's possible for someone to essentially tell and track everything you've ever done with all the money. And so there's going to be an interesting conversation potentially in the next few years about actually hardening the privacy on these networks and increasing the amount of scrutiny and security on places where there's account-based infrastructure or custodial infrastructure of personal identifying information. Because if you append both the personal identifying information and your entire public payment history, you essentially would be able to graph someone's total economic activity. And so there's a lot of challenges with some of this, and it makes regulating it particularly difficult.
If you were in charge, what would you put in place to stop these bad actors?
Well, fortunately, the bad actors tend to face justice. And we've seen that actually over the past year with, you know, famously the founder of FTX being brought, you know, to face the music for that person's extraordinary crimes and failures to take care of their client funds. We don't need new rules to deal with bad actors or frauds. We actually have very strong rules to deal with those things. And there's a special, you know, realm of hell, I think, saved for saboteurs and mutineers and fraudsters. And that's why Dante, you know, put that in his little body of work as well. And so, in short, it's about accountability. And, you know, these companies have a fiduciary duty to protect the precious information of their clients. And so, you know, when investors are thinking about who to work with, when retail customers are thinking about how to navigate exploring where they can place that trust, one of the interesting options for people in our space is to use trustless services, which is actually to not rely on any intermediary and just use an actual application where you yourself are the firm custodian of your assets. So this is an interesting model because if you're a gold bug, you may not actually want your bank to hold your gold because if there's a run on the bank or if the bank gets broken into and someone steals all the gold from the bank.
Nuclear war or something.
You know, in Ukraine and you hold your life savings in, you know, an account in Crimea, you're smoked, right? Yeah. If there's an invasion. And so one of the interesting things about digital currencies is that you can, with a wallet, basically hold as much or as little of bearer instruments directly in your pocket. And with that, you can then globally transact with it. And so we've covered the environmental piece. On the social piece, I hope I've demonstrated that, you know, in comparison to the traditional financial economies and cash instruments, which are used far more regularly for illicit activity, cryptocurrency isn't perfect. But because it's transparent, we can actually really track what's happening, which means we can mend it over time.
So I think you've explained the ESG piece very well. Thank you, Nick. I'm going to just correct you on one thing, which is you say unequivocally gold is environmentally damaging. It's interesting, if you go onto the World Gold Council's website, you'll see the video they've released recently with Idris Elba. You will see the extraordinary way in which they're reinvigorating communities, landscapes, putting in infrastructure, hydropower, you know, wealth, education, hospitalization. I mean, a real force for good. So I'll leave that with you. We'll put it out there. And since you mentioned Sam Bankman-Fried, for anybody listening who didn't have the chance, just before Christmas, Ravi Joseph and myself interviewed Michael Lewis on his fabulous book, was very controversial, not the interview, the book, but I think that it was a very pithy, funny, and, you know, we certainly enjoyed that interview.
So question, Nick, from me is, can you just give us a little bit of colour of how surprised you were with the demise of FTX and Binance and how it's kind of reacted to your company and how that's happened?
Having been in this industry now for a decade, I remember in the early days, everyone said it would be career suicide. This stuff would never work. That we already had great, you know, investment products like gold, and we didn't need these types of tools. In that, and then it was only used by nerds on the internet, and then it was only used by retail adopters that didn't have any sophistication. And now, a few years later, you know, we find ourselves with the largest institutions in the world offering you know, digital currency products to the investment base. So it's been an up and down 10 years, and we've had, you know, some very colorful characters come through, including Sam Bankman-Fried from FTX. You know, that episode was very painful to witness. And, you know, as someone who takes taking care of our clients and the reputation of our industry very seriously and has been combating misinformation and confusion about the space, and we have a lot of work to do still, obviously. I hope within the next decade, I can convince Simon here.
We're going to ask him at the end if he's been a bit more convinced.
But, you know, at the end of the day, people have their perspectives. But when you have bad actors that, you know, betray the trust of their clients, it makes everything more difficult. And, you know, I believe in basically a business Hippocratic oath, which is do no harm to your customers. And so watching people take advantage of their clients for greed, for narrow-mindedness, or for short-term gain, to me is particularly painful. But it also reinforces the importance of the relentless pursuit of integrity and working in this space for the right reasons and for the long haul. We are living in a state of potentially permanent inflation. And so there are dynamics at play now that, to me, are highly concerning. And I hope that the work that my firm and the good actors in the cryptocurrency industry are playing will, in the long run, help provide more social and economic utility to participants worldwide. And just like it was beneficial to HSBC to have Silicon Valley Bank die last year, they were able to acquire, you know, an incredible asset for a very low amount of money. When firms don't manage their risk well, other yeah. firms can come in and take advantage of those moments.
Yeah.
Nick, I've got two closing questions, which are general. This volatility around your business is immense. And how do you cope mentally with these extraordinary swings?
Yeah, we've been through huge downturns and also incredible upswings where, you know, the volumes in your revenues go up and down by 90% in very short periods of time. I talked to mentors of mine that have worked in the financial services industry, just like you two, who have these moments they talk about, whether it was the sovereign debt crisis or the great financial crisis or the dot-com bubble or, you know, these things where they have terrible PTSD and scarring from those, you know, over their careers. And I have some of those, and I feel like there's a few of them every year. And so, you know, I don't know if I have all the best coping mechanisms for dealing with volatility, but I try and maintain a longer-term perspective on the work. And, you know, you guys interviewed a personal hero of mine, General Petraeus, and I loved his new book, Conflict. And when he talks about his sort of leadership style, there are a few things that really resonated with me. And he talks about getting the big idea right, the big grand strategic idea right, and then communicating and articulating that big idea repeatedly, and then creating the conditions under which you can reassess and reevaluate so you can continue to pursue the right big idea for the moment. And so to me, the big idea for the past decade was that it was possible for a computer system to create a more fair, economic, and accessible financial system for the world. And I still think and believe that to be true. And if you fast forward to where we are today from where we started, if you had told me in 2011 that, you know, there'd be a $3 trillion asset class, hundreds of millions of users worldwide, and that BlackRock would be selling, you know, Bitcoin to my parents' generation, I would probably be dancing on top of the table. But I'm not here dancing, and I'm not here gloating. I think we have a huge amount of work to do still. And to me, that work is extremely motivating and keeps me up, keeps me busy.
Nick, my final question is, you've been very involved in your charity, Sky's the Limit. Just give us an update on where you are.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. So there are two things I care about in the world: reinventing the relationship people have with their wealth, and the other is inspiring a lot more entrepreneurship. I think entrepreneurship is an incredible path for wealth creation. It's what feeds our communities, what clothes us. It's how we learn about business and saving money and the value of building things that people find to be useful. And so skyslimit.org is a charitable organization here in the UK, as well as a 501c3 in the United States. It's a global mentorship platform that allows first-time entrepreneurs, predominantly from underrepresented or underserved backgrounds, to gain access to mentors and advisors from incredible companies like Accenture, Goldman Sachs, CVC Capital, PNC Bank, and many more. We provide entrepreneurship education, we provide a matchmaking service to mentors and advisors, and we have a funding system where we issue grants to entrepreneurs that are looking to get their first capital, whether that's to buy a lawnmower or to get some inventory or to set up their first website. Anyone can sign up for free. We just launched yesterday our iOS app for Sky's the Limit. It's been a huge investment from the team, and I'm very proud of that work. And yeah, we had the best year ever in 2023 with tens of thousands of entrepreneurs signing up from around the world. And the need for this is extraordinary. The changes in the workforce are, you know, happening at an unprecedented rate. AI is going to also change the employment landscape. And young people are going to need to increasingly turn to things like entrepreneurship to make ends meet. And so we're hopeful to play a small role in being a venue where entrepreneurs can practice entrepreneurship. And that's really sort of what we try and do, is create a safe place for people to do that. I'm never going to be an amazing figure skater, but if I go and practice every single day, I can get better at doing that. And the idea is to build a place where people can practice entrepreneurship. So that's what Sky's the Limit does, and it's a privilege to work on that with my team.
Capitalism has never been more important. Success should be celebrated more widely. It's a problem we're going to talk about in this country versus America, about why the UK and Europe can be chippy and not good at patting people on the back and saying, well done. Now, the great thing about the Money Maze podcast and me being the interviewer is I get to have the final word.
No, you don't. I'm going to get it. I just interject with that we need to put Sky's the Limit on Money Maze podcast /learn, which is a new initiative we've got going. We'd all encourage all our listeners to have a look there. Some great resources. And Nick, I've had a look at what you're doing there, and hats off to you. It's really impressive.
So, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. How do we do? So,
the last word.
So it's always good to be able to, in this research, read other people, and most of them are significantly smarter. It was Gary Clark, who's the CIO at All Street Digital, who wrote, "I'm convinced this technology will transform finance and more, but that does not mean you'll make any money betting on the existing set of token prices." And as you talked about BlackRock, I wondered if BlackRock had been able to do that in another era with tulips, where they wouldn't have had just as much demand. So I am with Warren Buffett, who, of course, along with Charlie Munger, had referred to cryptocurrencies as being crazy gambling. But I distinguish the power of blockchain and its enabling and protective components with the investment or the speculation in these cryptocurrencies. Our listeners are, you know, will make their own decisions, and I will make my own decision. But Nick, you've clearly created a business founded on, you know, great vision and hard work and protocols and, you know, ethics. I happen to be happy with my gold. Perhaps using a different Warren Buffett analogy, you don't need to swing at every pitch. So that is where I stand. Nick, it's been great to have you back here today.
Nick.
Will, nice to have you. I think that's... you'll always be welcome. Thank you very much today.
I've really enjoyed it. And Nick, thank you so much for your time and enlightening us.
Thank you, Will. And thank you, Simon.
Content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.